Okay, this is August 3rd, 2008. This is our fourth session with Gerd Stern, and we've done 9 hours already, approximately, and we're going to go for another 2 or 3 hours if the energy stays up. So, Gerd, we left off the last time talking about the I would call it a programmed happening. It was interesting what you did in San Francisco. It wasn't just a spontaneous happening. It was programmed, designed, spontaneity happened within it, but it was a bit different than what those guys, Alan Kaprow and those guys, were doing in New York, right?
Alan Kaprow?
Yeah,
I would say, yeah, I was, you're right. Now I'm beginning to get the timeline a little better. Sure, the Cedar Bar, for instance, was before I went out to San Francisco, and also John Chamberlain, because it was during the time that I was with Barbara and I had my first show in New York. Yeah, so I'm beginning to get it more into focus.
Okay, about this idea, we can work on it. And I want to go back to the abstract expressionist scene in the Cedar Tavern. We forgot to do that, but...
Well, I mean, it wasn't just abstract expressionists. They were heavy at the Cedar Bar, but it was also people in the avant-garde music scene and pop artists and, you know, it was a very mixed crowd. The abstract expressionists have gotten most of the, you know...
Press.
The press about it, but there were a lot of poets also. I mean, Joel Oppenheimer, Leroy Jones, who was still Leroy Jones at the time, and many, many more. But like I said before we started recording, there was a migration from bars on McDougal Street, the San Remo and the Mineta Tavern, to a little further west to the Cedar Bar, and then like eventually, not too much later, to Max's Kansas City, a little further uptown, a little further west. Right? East. I should have said east, not west.
The migration from Mineta to Cedar Tavern was east.
Yes, it was east.
So, now you agree that this would be before 55, before you're ensconced in the barge in San Francisco?
Well, re-ensconced in the barge.
Yes, re-ensconced, right.
Yeah, because that was when we went out and Stuart Brand had rented the barge from me.
Right, right.
So that's a whole... the first barge period was much earlier, right?
Yeah, so I'm talking about that early period before you first went out there. There was the tavern, the Mineta, and that was in the...
That was also... even at the time in the late 40s, in the very early 50s, when Carl Solomon and I and John Hoffman and Philip LaMattia and Joe Gould and, and Stanley Gould, they weren't related, and lots of other people.
Was Joe Gould the famous journalist?
I don't know that he was a famous journalist. He had supposedly written, I can't remember what it was called, kind of a history of everything. It had a name, but I don't recall. He was fairly old, much older than us, and small, and he was always around, and usually pretty many sheets to the wind.
Was he... Did they talk about him in the 90s? It sounds like when I was in New York, there was something.
Yeah, he was kind of, he was a village character.
Yeah.
Yeah, well known. And, but there were lots of people.
Anton
Rosenberg and his brother.
Right, now these people, was Jackson Pollock, Willem de Kooning, and some of those people, were they around there?
Well, they were around, but it was when the Cedar Bar started really happening, that they really were frequenters of that. And, you know, Gorky and the whole bunch of people.
Hans Hoffman.
What?
Hans Hoffman.
Yeah. Well, Hans Hoffman was a much earlier and older than that generation, and he had the school on 8th Street.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. And so he was more of a patrician.
Yeah.
And a mentor, and he wasn't such a big drinker as all of the people you mentioned before.
Yeah, he's not searching or out there carousing. He's like the principal of the school.
Yeah, but he's also had a much earlier reputation from Europe. He was one of the refugee people who left Europe, and there was a huge amount of them. You know, the famous chess player Marcel Duchamp.
Yeah,
he was more or less the same. And Hans also had a school in the summer up in Provincetown.
Yeah. Now, did you ever run across Peggy Guggenheim? Because she championed these people, Jackson.
Yeah,
Hall.
I barely. I didn't really.
She had the Surrealist Museum or something.
Well, she had a gallery and
kind
of a proto museum, and you know, she was at a social strata which I wasn't part of.
Right. So the now John Chamberlain was part of this early 50s part we're talking about.
No. We're talking a little later now with John, because John lived in Rockland County at the time that I was in Woodstock and at the church.
Right.
And with Barbara, near the land, and that's when I knew John. And I continued to know him for a long time, both in New York and in California. And not until he broke up his first marriage and also in New Mexico and married an heiress. We kind of lost touch. I've seen him a couple of times at openings of his, but we're not buddies like we used to be.
Okay, so you was there the 10th Street school or scene or something in the early
70s? Yeah, well, that was a bunch of different people. Again, that Mark DeSouvreau.
Yeah.
I mean, the DeSouvreaus were all friends of mine. Both from California and New York, Mark and the people who later on started Drop City in Colorado, and
I remember
Tony,
Drop City, yeah.
Yeah, little Tony, who went to New Mexico, and that's Frosty Myers. That's again a different group. They're not abstract expressionists. They were, you know, the 10th Street group, and they had a gallery on, somewhere like Leakers and Houston and Houston or somewhere around there. Or maybe it was West Broadway.
Okay, so I want to ask you both your state of mind. When you're there in the early 50s and all these scenes happening, are you naturally an outsider, or are you feeling excited about the energy, or are you indifferent? What is your mood? You're a young person. What do you think of all this thing? Do you think it's like a whole world is opening up, or you find it tedious or in between?
No, I mean, I'm part of it, but, you know, I'm not a painter. I'm a poet. It was before I started, you know. It wasn't until I was up in Rockland County with Barbara that I really started doing visual stuff.
And that was after reading McLuhan, or around the same time?
Well, no, I started before McLuhan. From that came The Transformer, which was a project that never really got off the ground, but I have the proposal for it, and it was a Guggenheim application.
Okay, what I'm getting at is that in the punk aesthetic, or in the 80s, the kids are all, quote, alienated. they might be hanging out with each other, but they seem more despairing and isolated. That was that the feeling for you in the 50s?
No, absolutely not. I mean, somewhat, you know, alienated from the middle class scene, because we, most of us didn't have any money, and most of us didn't have any way of earning money. I mean, there were some people who used to come down, you know, after their 9-to-5s or on the weekends, but most of the main characters, and I don't mean the painters who were already kind of medium successful. I mean, John Chamberlain was, by that time, he wasn't the kind of, you know, major figure that he is today.
Right.
But he was already on the way to success. He had a very good gallery which supported him.
But you felt that you were part of a community, even though it was poor.
Yeah,
it was
yeah.
fun.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, there were a lot of people who considered themselves friends, not just acquaintances.
Mm.
I mean, you know, any day you would go into one of those bars, and you would either stand at the bar or sit at a table with people that you knew and that you didn't have any problem. Nobody would say, "Hey, what are you doing sitting at this table?" You know?
Yeah.
I mean, everybody was. It was a very friendly kind of ambiente.
So, Leroy Jones, do you have any anecdotes about him in the early 60s before you go out to San Francisco? Again,
Leroy,
to do the show.
Hey, you know, Leroy was an activist and a political animal, and he was married to a wonderful woman who supported him, Jewish, whom he later abandoned because she wasn't black and she wasn't part of, you know, what he was persuaded was his mission. She's a good writer and a good poet. She's still around.
You remember her name?
Yeah, I remember her name. You remember, honey, do you remember Leroy Jones' wife's name? Yeah, Hetty Jones.
Ah. Who are you speaking to in the background?
My friend Judith.
Oh, okay. So the she knows people from back then. She knows that history.
Well, she's a magazine editor of a Jewish magazine, so Hetty Jones fits into that group.
Right. It says here in the wiki thing, he left his wife and their two children, moved to Harlem, considering himself at that time a black cultural nationalist. That's in italics. Later, Hetty Cohen, in her autobiography, How I Became Hetty Jones, in 1996.
Yes, right. Great book.
Yeah, claimed that Barack had mistreated her during the time of their marriage.
True.
Okay, so let's go to San Francisco in November, December 63, where you put on this pretty extraordinary happening, which I'm saying is a bit different from the happenings
wait a minute. That happening, I must have been by that time in Sausalito in San Francisco for at least 6 months.
Right, you were going around trying to get support to set it up.
Right, and to build a contact is the only love.
Right.
Right.
I mentioned this to you privately later after the last session that making contact is a static function in linguistics. Maintaining contact. So again, you have this static. The panels and the information societies become hyperphatic, and at the same time, you anticipate it may not have, you probably didn't mean it, but you have contact is the only love, right?
Right.
Well, the phatic way of that would be that you are listening to someone, and the person has not finished their story. You may be impatient, but you keep it going. You go, yes, yeah, oh, then what happened next? These are phatic functions of language. And that's maintaining contact, and that's this kind of human love.
Absolutely. And when I first showed it, there was an artist in San Francisco who made a beautiful piece for me, which was called Love is the Only Contact. but I disagreed with him.
Yeah, he missed the fatic point. So at this performance, I still want you to, can you explain how it was a bit different from a happening?
Well, a happening has a kind of a meaning or a signification of, you know, a slice of life, right?
Yeah.
What we did was kind of, we set up an intentional multi-log among a large continuity of people, and we mixed it with their own inputs and other inputs, both visual and oral. So that's a completely different intention.
Right, and actually you're showing awareness of the, quote, the media by having known people as part of the content. And those images or stigmas were part of the meanings that would come out of it, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And we gave them clues. They were not only clues, but they were meant as provocations. You know, I mean, the sociologists could phone into the cubicles and mention a subject which the people could talk about in order to make things happen, right?
No, that's good. And by the middle 60s, McLuhan wrote an essay, The Environment is a Programmed Happening. And he said that the satellite environment made all the older media from TV, radio, and bulldozers as the content in a programmed, coordinated global theater. Now, it doesn't mean that the programming was successful. There's all kinds of accidents. But there's a programming aspect in what you're describing. You guys
are... Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah.
We programmed it, and we didn't program it on a what you might call a sequential basis, because we simply set up the physicality and the technology, and we then let it go. You know, however, there were a lot of accidents and coincidences. You know, I mean.
Yeah, that's the happening part. The program's happening. Two aspects.
Yeah, the accidents were feedback, you know, and technical breakdowns.
Yeah.
The intention got very mixed up with the coincidental, accidental things which took place in time.
Right, and that showed more the way the society was than the happening.
You could say that, yes, absolutely.
And, you know, it's right after the Kennedy assassination. The Kennedy assassination, many people would believe, was a programmed happening. It was planned and scripted and all that stuff that may never be understood.
That certainly was a belief.
Yeah. So,
it wasn't the only thing like that that I did. The destruction, which was also about that time, was also a very programmed happening.
The destruction? I don't know that.
That was done at a theater, and it was at the time that we and our, in quotes, enemy were discussing the mutual destruction of, you know, of weapons, right?
Yes.
Airplanes and things, and the invitation invited people to come to a destruction and to bring things which were meaningful and valuable to them, but which kind of they needed to destroy to free themselves of that, you know, kind of hang-up. So we had a destruction team with all kinds of, you know, sledgehammers and a pneumatic drill and big guys, you know, and the people would bring something up and the team would destroy it. And we had a lot of television coverage, all the television cameras came in. It was kind of an experiment in how you could spend very little money putting the thing together. All we had to do was rent the old theater and get tremendous kind of coverage out of it.
Interesting. This is after the what's the title of the November 27th show? Contact is the only other. Is that
No. The Contact is the piece that was part of the show. That is Who Are You and What's Happening?
Oh yeah, right. This the destruction is the same time.
In the same time grain, yes.
But after,
I can't remember the exact name. The exact date.
But does it come after Who Are You and What Is Happening?
I think so. I have to look it up, and I don't feel like getting up and getting the paper.
Okay.
I mean, if you want me to, I'll look.
No, that's all right. The point is, it's all within that same couple of months period, the end of 1960.
Yeah, and it was all post-reading McLuhan, yeah.
Right. Now, what's interesting to me, I just watched this PBS, I think it is, no, American Masters documentary on Andy Warhol. It's 4 hours long.
Mm.
And it gives a lot of interesting details, and it quotes him in his diary that the reason he painted the factory silver was that was the color that was everywhere in TV because the astronauts in the early 60s were floating around the planet and getting ready to land on the moon, and they were wearing these silver costumes, and that silverness of the beginning of the space age was the reason he painted his factory silver.
Yeah, I don't know. Silver is very interesting. I actually use quite a lot of silver paint. We also use the Mylar, which is silver. You know, silver also is somehow a very Jewish metal.
Why would that be?
I don't know. Is that true, Judith? Silver is a very Jewish metal? No? Yeah, I don't know. You know, it's...
It goes with the culture.
I like silver better than gold.
Right. You're thinking that silver goes with Jewish culture?
Yeah, for some reason.
Okay.
It also goes with Mexican culture, for some reason.
Right. Well, the reason I bring up Warhol is that, at least subconsciously, he was beginning to pick up on the satellite effect that McLuhan would describe, and that's why he was so impersonal. He would just put on the camera and let anybody do anything. He knew the older media, like film.
Wait a minute. Andy was a voyeur.
Yes.
So we're describing that he let anybody do anything. It wasn't really anything. It was something that he wanted to see.
Yes.
He liked to see people using opiates and getting messed up. He liked to see people being violent. He liked to see people having sex. You know, the aberrations were, you know, the many hours of the Empire State Buildings and the other, that kind of thing. But that was a different kind of intention of his.
Right. Let me supplement that. The first one he did was John Giorno, a sometime lover of his. Maybe you knew John Giorno.
Yeah, I just saw John in Paris for the first time in decades. We had a very nice couple of drinks together, and we were at a party and at the opening of Trost Soccer. He has a piece in the show called Eating the Sky.
what was the name of the show? The
Traces of the Sacred, Trace du Sacre.
Ah.
It's still there. It's closing on August 11th, and it opens September 17th in Munich at the Haus der Kunst.
And what do you have in there?
We have a huge painting called Shiva.
Yeah.
One of the six paintings out of the Tabernacle, the Usco Tabernacle, and the miniature of Contact is the Only Love. And I lent them A Tree of Life by Harry Smith, which belongs to me.
Right. The journal, he was a poet. What did he offer? A painting? Is he a painter too?
Well, it's a painting, but I mean it's a phrase, eating the sky.
Mm.
He's basically a poet.
Yes.
He's aged rather well.
Yeah, in the documentary they show him sleeping. It was the first film that Andy made, and he just, I guess he was hanging out at Andy's place, and he went upstairs to fall asleep, and Andy filmed him.
He filmed a lot of sleepers.
Right. Now, Andy says, around that time, I am a camera. And what I'm saying is that, yes, he was a voyeur, but he was a technical apparatus. The older media were the content of the satellite theater.
Well, I mean, wait a minute. He was a technical apparatus. He hired people who were technical apparatus.
Yes,
he didn't do it himself.
That's right.
He hardly did anything himself.
And that's where
he's also in that show, by the way. The best painting I've ever seen by him. It's something like Diamond Dust. It's nothing like any of his other paintings. It's kind of a religious statement.
And
it's all black.
Wow, was this something from his early years or later years? Did you notice?
Too, I really don't know. I'd have to look it up. But it's very, very un-Warhol painting.
Well, here's the thing. In the documentary, it comes out that he went to church twice on Sunday because his mother was very religious, and he sat there for very long services, and he stared at the stained glass tapestry or panoply of repeating images of the saints.
Mm-hmm.
And they make the case that he actually continued with that motif in his repeating silkscreens. It was what he saw for many years as a kid in church. So when you mention this religious thing, it makes me think of that. Okay, yeah. What I'm saying is that the satellite turns television, movies, and media and books into programmed environments, and the real hidden ground is the satellite. And now he isn't totally conscious of it, but he's instinctively acting it out by becoming this impersonal object that just sets up this factory of filming and providing content.
And he wasn't, our motivations and intentions were very positive in terms of consciousness. Our take on Andy and his people were that their intentions were basically negative in terms of consciousness.
Yeah. Now, let's come back to Andy later, because do you know him before you do your show in late 63? Do you know of his work at that point?
Yeah, sure. I've met him and know of him before then, yes.
Yeah, right when he was competing with Rauschenberg and Lichtenstein and those people. They go into this in the documentary.
Well, I mean, it was Leo Castelli's group, yes.
So you were on this. You would go and look at the work.
I knew Leo and Yvonne, yes.
Did you present any of your work or had an idea presenting your work?
Yes, they knew our work, but they weren't into it.
Okay, so at this, who are you? What's the title? Who are you?
Who are you and what's happening?
And what's happening? This professor or gallery curator, Mr. Alvin Bickin?
Balkind.
Yeah, I have Balkind, Balkind. Alvin Balkind is at the show, and he.
Yeah, I had no idea.
And he noticed the McLuhan quotes.
Well, he had invited McLuhan to lecture at UBC.
And that would be January 64. That was just coming up.
Yep.
And he mentions this to you, and he notices you have the
quote. He calls me about a week, 10 days after the show.
And he says what to you?
He says, listen, I noticed that I was at your show. I happened to be in San Francisco. I noticed that you must know about McLuhan. I said, yeah. So he said, well, he's coming to lecture at the university here in Vancouver. How would you like to come up and do that show for us while he's here? I said, that sounds great. Do you have a budget? So he said, and why don't you bring some of the pieces that you showed at the museum? I said, well, some of the small ones I could bring. So I did, and we had a little show in the gallery, and we did a multimedia show, and Marshall spoke, and then he and I answered questions. And one of the answers is on the Billy Master, where he says, you know, that he's a Victorian, and he doesn't really, all this new technology is a little much for him, because he really likes the toasters where you open it up and put the toast in, not the pop-up kite.
Now, yeah, the Billy Master, we should explain that. That's a audio collage?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have that, and yes, McLuhan is, it's from that show, I guess, you did several.
Yes, it's from the Vancouver show.
Yeah, and in my mind, he says, the artist always is showing us new things are happening. He goes on about the artist, but there's a certain detachment about the role of the artist, because he's seen the artist now as kind of obsolete, the traditional artist. And you can hear him with that reservation in that statement that I've heard on the Billy Master, I think. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, absolutely. But, you know, on the other hand, he was exceptionally friendly and kind of interested in what we were doing, because he had never seen anything like it. Well, neither had we. You know, really, we hadn't seen anything like it except for what we did in San Francisco. It was a first of its kind. I mean, we didn't have as much in Vancouver. We didn't have television. We had, you know, actual closed-circuit television at the museum in San Francisco, which in those days, and we borrowed it. I mean, Judith McBean, who kind of coordinated the programs and who is still a good friend and a patron, she was able to get all kinds of, I mean, she was, you know, come from a very prominent San Francisco family. She got the television stuff. She got the telephone company to loan us telephones and connective, you know, equipment. And we had, you know, very advanced technology for 1963.
But not in Vancouver.
Well, in Vancouver, it was much simpler. We had, you know, I think four channels of audio, and we had slide projectors and film. That was about it. And I had a little show of collage pieces.
You mentioned Judith McBean. You found it amazing about the feedback and all that unplanned stuff that happened. Did people excited about it, or do you think the place thing was a disaster? The San Francisco.
Well, it was a disaster for Alfred Frankenstein, because he wrote that wonderful review,
yes,
Landmark of a Flop. But it wasn't a disaster for us, and it wasn't a disaster for a lot of the audience. It was for some. You know, it was fascinating for a lot of people, and even now, I once in a while meet somebody who was there and tells me how inspiring it was.
Interesting. So Marshall sees not as complex, but Marshall's lucky. He's finding out the latest scene right away.
Well, in a sense, yes. And he understands. He's amazed to hear from me that through John Cage, I read the report. You know, because I don't know his work. I've never read The Mechanical Bride.
Right.
Or The Gutenberg Galaxy.
Yeah, he's looking at this performance, and then you can hear it on the Billy Master, one of some of his comments, but he also has to process the fact that he inspired it.
Yes, exactly. and he's a little mixed about that, because, like he says, he's a Victorian.
Right. Now, John Brockman, in that book called 100 Philosophers, he put out about 1977 with Edwin Schlossberg, they have, I don't know if it's this show, because you do several with McLuhan, but he quotes McLuhan saying to you after, he goes, "Gerd, this is all well and good, but what's it got to do with me?"
I don't know. You know, I mean, John is not above making things up.
Right. But it's it's an approximation of what he said in Vancouver, right?
Well,
or his attitude.
No, I don't. No, his attitude was, look, this is not my trip, you know.
What's it got to do with me?
Well, no, I mean, he knows that he's written about it.
Yes.
He's predicted it, you know.
Yeah.
But he says, "Understand, I'm a fuddy-duddy." bullshit, he wasn't a fuddy-duddy.
That's right, you know? Exactly. He was putting you on. He always was a contrarian, so if something's going on, he'll pretend he's the other person.
Right, exactly. That's what I mean. He knew he was very hip.
Yeah, and you did you pick that up about him right then, or did you have to get
Yes, absolutely. Because hey, he wasn't the first academic I'd ever come across.
Right.
But he was a very kindly, friendly, and ultimately sophisticated human being.
Yeah. Now, did you go out to dinner with him or hang out with Alvin?
We had social contact during that time that he was there.
Now, I don't have it here, I don't think, but I have Xeroxes of your subsequent correspondence with them. Is there anything you want to say about that? That started pretty quickly, didn't it? You kept in touch.
Yeah, we kept in touch for years. I've been working on my archive, and in various boxes there are letters to him and from him.
Right, and I have some of them. You gave me some samples, but now...
Well, I don't remember what I gave you, so I wouldn't know.
Yeah, there's about 10 letters, something like that.
Hey, wow. Uh-huh.
Okay, the thing is, one side thing, when you asked Alvin if he had the budget, did he have the budget? Did he help you?
He gave us some money, yeah. You know, in those days, it wasn't a lot of money like it is now, but sure, we didn't have gas money to drive. We had a Volkswagen Bug. And we drove it up to. First, we went to Seattle, and at Vancouver, we met these collectors from Seattle. The guy who owned the Space Needle restaurant and a lot of other things, Bagley Wright and his wife.
Yeah.
And they invited us on our way back to stay with them, the three of us, Judy, Michael, and I. And when we were staying with them, Bagley, they had a pool, and I was swimming in the pool, and he told me that Ted Rethke had died in that pool. Of course, Ted was a friend of mine.
Yes.
So that kind of was a very shocking experience.
And it was a mentor to Anne.
Yes.
We talked about. So, now, remember that up there in the Pacific Northwest, someone did a review and that caused a bit of trouble? That already happened?
Oh, that was a different time.
Before or after?
That was
when did you guys do the film and you got run out of the? You had to sneak out of the student showing and all that. Was that after this?
Well, you got that all mixed up. But it was. I showed the film in Eugene, Oregon, at the university, and then I was staying with another friend of mine, Abbott Fraser, on a lake near there, Lake Siltkus. And a week later, I went back to the university to see another friend of mine who was showing film, and while I was in the audience, he got up on stage and he says, "I hope that what happened to a friend of mine last week doesn't happen to me. The police are still looking for him." And I thought to myself, "Now I wonder who that could be." It was me. And I realized it very quickly, and I snuck out of the auditorium and fled back to Lake Silkus. And then Abbott was able to get the newspapers, and it was a huge mess of a woman had complained that she had all kinds of cramps and physical things after seeing the film, and it went up to the president of the university, and he fired the people who had the Northwest Review, who had invited me and this other guy. And the Northwest Review, I had known those people because I had gotten for them M.C. Richards' translation of Artaud's The Theater and Its Double.
Right.
And so it was a complex situation, and it lasted for a long time. But I never got busted for it because they didn't know I was around.
Now, Scott, did we discuss this already on tape, this incident? Does it sound familiar? Because I read it a few weeks ago, and I was going to bring it up. Now, did this happen before Vancouver or after? Can you remember? I noticed after you drive across and you make the film, the highway signs and the woman's body, and that causes a little scandal somewhere. Isn't that...
In Utah, in Salt Lake City.
Is that after this San Francisco show in Vancouver or before?
Wait a minute. I think it's after.
Yeah, because you go back to Woodstock and then...
Yeah, but I don't remember when we showed it in Eugene. You know, it's certainly a date that's ascertainable.
Okay.
I
could probably look it up on the... in the oral history of Bancroft College. But the thing is that you, after being in Vancouver, do you go back to San Francisco or do you go back to New York?
Oh, to San Francisco.
And what happens there for a while? What do you do?
Oh, we did a number of commissions we were given a couple of old pinball machines, and we made a piece for the company, kind of a mechanical amusement company in L.A., and then we did several commissions for the Immaculate Heart College of, Sister Magdalene Mary and Mary Carita. A friend of ours was teaching there, Paul Laporte, who was part of the kind of... post Bauhaus group from Europe.
What university is this?
It's the Immaculate Heart College in Los Angeles.
Right. I have a note here. Dennis Hopper at L.A. show. Now, this is when
Dennis and I were in the same gallery, the David Stewart Gallery.
And that's after Vancouver. So you're in sort of around L.A. after Vancouver in 64.
Well, active.
Showing.
Yeah.
Did you have much interaction with Dennis Hopper at that point?
Yes, and later. Because later with Bert Schneider and Bob Rafelson. And
right, that's 67, 68.
Dennis wanted me to do the sound for Easy Rider, but somehow I had too many other things going on.
Okay, so here's, in 64, Tim Leary is starting to get publicity. Do you recall him in that year, or is it 65? I mean, is Millbrook starting yet?
Well, by the time I got back to the East Coast, I had done acid while I was in San Francisco.
In the 63 period?
Yeah, before Who Are You and What's Happening.
Right,
in
right.
In fact, on the second night of Who Are You, I was tripping.
Right, yeah.
But So by the time I got back, I don't know, man. Timing is very difficult for me. I originally met Timothy and some of the people in Boston before they, and then later on in Millbrook.
Okay, well, maybe this will help jog your memory. You go back to the church. The church is happening at that point, right? Has Steve got the church? Yeah, he has.
Yeah, Steve had the church before I left.
Right. Now, they hear about what you've done in San Francisco and gone up to Vancouver. So is there new inspiration when you go back, having met McCoy?
Yeah, Steve wants to be part of the multimedia trip.
Does that mean he stops painting?
No.
But he wants to help you.
He wants to be part of it.
Right, but that's...
He started making 8mm films and, we paintings that we photographed and, and he got involved in some of the sound tapes that we made. It was him and I, and then we sent for Michael to come back.
Right, so the... it's you and Michael mainly in San Francisco, and then it's Steve and you, but then you bring Michael back to New York.
Well, what happens is...
And he's only young. Michael's young.
Yeah, Michael's in his late teens. What happens is that I talk about everything that Michael did technically, and Steve and I are not technically oriented. We're technically interested, which is a different thing. And Steve says, so why don't you ask Michael to come back? I said, well, gee, I don't know if he wants to come to the East Coast. He says, let's call him. So we call him, and he said, sure, I want to come back east. In the meantime, I had gotten him involved in a project for two recording things, one at Alexis's restaurant and the other recording Harry Parch. So, that had happened while I was going back east. And then, after a while back east, we called him and he came, and he's been there ever since.
Right. And for those listening, Michael is interviewed in the May 2008 issue of Art Form, right? It's Art Form, I think it is.
Yeah. And there's lots of other, Michael Callahan material from all the way from 1963 up to the present.
Right. So, has he left Pauline Oliveri? That scene
Oliveros,
that he was working. Oliveros, yeah.
And Ramon Sender and what's the third one?
It's like forgetting your mother's name.
Martin Sabat.
Yeah.
Okay. Has he left the San Francisco Tape Music Center? I think that was about the time when the Tape Music Center moved to Mills College in Oakland.
So it was natural. He could leave. I mean, they were moving. He was moving.
Yeah. It was natural.
Now, it was interesting to look at this Warhol documentary in the two-weeks period since we last talked, because there's an interesting parallel of what he's working on and what you guys are working on. And he has been in L.A. Andy Warhol. On the day that Marilyn Monroe was either murdered or committed suicide in August, I think it was August 4th, it was McLuhan's wedding anniversary, 1962, tomorrow in relation to this tape. He closed his show, his first show out there. Irving Blum, is that sound?
Yep.
Yeah, Irving Blum was interested, had a gallery out there. So he showed maybe the Campbell soup can stuff or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then Marilyn Monroe dies on the day that Andy closes that Campbell soup show. And he immediately starts work on his silk screening of Marilyn Monroe, which becomes a big hit when that happens. And I think he comes back out to L.A. in 63 after he makes these silk screens, and he is sponsored by Dennis Hopper at some gallery, and then he goes to a party.
Dennis was at the David Stewart Gallery, but it seems to me that Andy was at the Dwan Gallery. I'm not sure. D-W-A-N.
Yeah, I shouldn't say that Dennis sponsored him. Dennis was into Andy's stuff, and they show footage of...
Dennis, at that time, was not an actor. He was a director. He was an artist.
And an actor. Beginning to be an actor in the...
Beginning, but he was married to the daughter of a big Hollywood star.
Yeah, was it Leland Hayward? I'm not sure. Broadway guy. I had looked that up, but I'll check that on the wiki in a minute. But the thing is that in the documentary, Dennis, they show footage of him being in an early Andy Warhol film. Might have been with Taylor Mead. But the reason I bring this up is that Dennis has a party for Andy after. And at the party, he meets Sal Mineo and Troy Donahue. And he said that was the greatest night of his life. Because he probably knew they were gay. He was gay, you know, Andy Warhol. And it was just gay icons. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I got it.
Yeah, so...
Listen, the gay scene in L.A. was huge. One of the biggest gay galleries was the Ralph Nelson Gallery.
Ross Nelson.
Ralph, R-O-L-F.
Oh, okay. And it was known that it was featuring gay artists.
Absolutely.
Was that known in society, or was the gay world still underground?
No, it wasn't underground in Hollywood.
Yeah, I mean, you had Rock Hudson, everybody was gay, and I guess everybody knew that. I mean, not in the...
I don't know what everybody knew, but, I mean, the gay scene in L.A. was enormous. I mean, it was pretty big in New York, too.
Yes, like Rauschenberg and...
Jasper.
Jasper Johns were lovers at the time. But they didn't tell anybody. They kept that secret.
What do you mean? I mean, what about Cage?
Yes, and Mercy Cunningham. But the...
Yeah,
But here's the thing.
What about Alan and his whole crowd? It was pervasive.
Right, but in the documentary, they point out that Rauschenberg and Johns kept it secret for the mainstream world. Beg your pardon?
Secret. You know, what is the secret? There are no secrets in 20th and 21st century information technology. I mean, it wasn't a secret to everybody that I knew, so why was it a secret?
Well, in the documentary for...
Documentaries. I mean,
right, but this is in the Time magazine world. They would not be saying it because they said Andy pushed it a little further and allowed that to come out a bit, and he had to hide his gay stuff. They were saying,
"Who, Andy?"
Yeah, they said that Andy.
Andy never hid anything.
That's right. That was made him different from Johns and Rose.
Oh well, the difference is that Andy was a rebellious lowlife, successful lowlife.
Yeah.
And Rauschenberg and Johns were middle-class people.
Right, and they were going towards high society.
And Andy was cafe society, which is a whole different trip.
Right. It's sort of like a subset of the world that you were in, or a side...
No, I mean, we were in a... in an avant-garde, creative, active, working world. You know, we weren't a big party scene. I mean, we did multimedia parties for people for money.
Are you distinguishing that from the phrase cafe society?
Yes.
Okay. So Andy was in a world between the middle-class world of John's and your world...
both their worlds were financially lucrative worlds.
Yeah.
Ours wasn't.
Right. Now, we mentioned Dennis Hopper's first wife. It was Brooke Hayward, the daughter...
Yes, right. Brooke Hayward, right.
The daughter of Leland Hayward, who was a big Broadway producer.
And what was the mother?
The mother might have been Pamela... who's the famous, she became the big power broker. Let me just check that. Do you know who I mean? Pamela Harrington? What's her name? She married the governor.
Brooks' mother.
Okay.
Leland's wife.
All right. Okay, Leland Hayward was a popular, powerful, and wealthy Hollywood and Broadway agent and theatrical producer. He was best remembered as the producer of the Broadway stage production South Pacific and The Sound of Music.
Right.
Now it says, just moving quickly, in the early 40s he handled about 150 artists including Fred Astaire, who had been his first client, Jimmy Stewart, yeah. Ernest Hemingway, Boris Karloff, Judy Garland, Ginger Rogers, as well as the two former husbands of his wife, Henry Fonda and William Wyler.
Yeah, well, who was the wife?
Yeah, let's get to the wife here.
That doesn't matter.
Marriages. He married the Texas debutante Lola Gibbs. They were divorced in 34. He married his client and the talented stage and screen actress Margaret Sullivan.
Brooke was Margaret Sullivan's daughter.
Right, and she was the ex-Mrs. Henry Fonda. They had three children, Brooke.
Right.
And, okay, so Dennis Hopper married the Pamela Churchill. In 1958, Hayward was introduced to Pamela Churchill, the mistress of Elie de Rothschild. He proposed to her the following year, and...
that's all a different history, but...
Yeah, but Pamela Churchill creates Clinton. Pamela Churchill, she marries the Harriman, who was he a governor?
Yes, he was the governor.
Yeah, so she...
But, I mean, the thing about Dennis was when he was married to Brooke, he was totally middle class. He wore three-piece suits, and he was, very, very civil, and he made beautiful little metal collages. I mean, very beautiful stuff. And it wasn't until much later that he got involved with Schneider, and I'm going out to see Bert Schneider in October, actually, in L.A. But when he got involved with them, he got deeply, and Peter Fonda, he got... this is all, family.
Right, Fonda,
He got into drugs.
Right, that's the late 60s.
And then he became, a terror.
That's right, a coke addict.
And he beat up his girl at the time, Daria Halperin.
Yes, that's listed here. But the thing is that in the by 63, 64, he is interested in the avant-garde because he's appearing in a Warhol thing, unless you see Warhol not really as avant-garde, just stylish, fashionable.
Well, and Warhol's people were all opiate users.
Yeah. So it has here that he was with Brooke Hayward from 61 to 69.
Really? That late? Wow.
Yeah, and then
she was a beauty, by the way.
Brooke Hayward.
Yes.
Yeah, and he was with Michelle. He married Michelle Phillips of the Mamas and Papas, and he was with her for a week. Married for a week in October 1970. And then he married Daria Halperin, and for those listening, she's the actress in... Antonioni's Zabriskie Point.
Zabriskie Point, yeah. And I was very friendly with her parents, Lawrence Halperin, the landscape architect, and Anne Halperin, the dancer who I told you about with Harry Parch.
That's right. She's avant-garde.
So I knew Daria when she was a little girl.
There's not many people, Scott, who Kurt hasn't met. Anyways, in all this thread of counterculture, I guess, that becomes a media splash. But
except the Halperins weren't exactly avant-garde. They were, kind of cultural icons.
Anna, you're talking about the mother.
And Lawrence, her husband, Larry.
Well, right, that's part of the San Francisco scene in the 50s.
Well, Larry was international. I mean, he worked all over the globe. He wrote some wonderful books, one of which I reviewed for Landscape Architecture magazine, believe it or not.
When was that? What period is that? 50s, 60s, 70s?
Probably 50s, yeah.
Okay. On the side, if you do you remember an L.A. person named David Greenberg doing a multimedia installation in the L.A. major museums? In
no, I don't remember.
Okay, just he's someone I've met here in Maui. Okay, back to we're talking about Dennis Hopper and Warhol. And so Warhol, he in the documentary, he meets his dream comes true when he meets Sal Mineo and Troy Donahue, and that's in 63, 64. And then he comes back, and that's when he starts the factory and starts making his films. Now, you're back in New York, and you guys are going to cross, you and Andy Warhol are going to cross paths in a couple of years, directly involved in multimedia environments. What is happening? Are you aware of what Andy's doing in 64, 65 and the films being shown at the Anthology Film Archives and Jonas Mekas' scene?
Yes, absolutely.
Right. But you guys are up at the church trying to create multimedia environments and starting to connect to the
network. Well, I don't remember the exact date when we first did shows for Jonas, but it was around that time.
Yes, it was... That would jump ahead a couple of years. About 66 is when Brockman comes in to substitute for Jonas Mekas' show. Isn't that without?
But that was yeah. I don't think that was necessarily. Maybe it was the same first show we did. Was that 66? I don't remember.
I think so, but we haven't got there. So let's go back to. Is it this in this period that you're going up to Woodstock a lot, also?
Yeah, we have Judy and I have a house on the Maverick in Woodstock.
Right.
It's her house, yeah.
So tell us the story about the night you're hanging out with a party with Bob Dylan, and he starts aiming the gun. You remember that story?